This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. It's the final frantic days of the New South Wales election campaign as Labor tries to unseat the coalition government, which is making its case for a fourth term. In the run-up to Saturday's poll, we've heard from voters in seats held by Labor, the Independents and the Nationals. So our reporter Matt Bamford headed out to Liberal-held electorates in Sydney to find out what voters think of the coalition's 12-year legacy.
Stand back from the closing doors.
The nine-minute train ride between Chatswood and Macquarie University in Sydney's northwest is a popular route. Since the Northwest Metro line opened in 2019, students and office workers like Ruth filter through the driverless carriages at all times of the day.
Yes, I do use the metro and it's very useful. Look, it certainly has helped. There are some parts of the city that are not well served by transport.
The researcher who commutes from southwest Sydney says it's a different story closer to her home.
I actually live in Campsie and it's been a debacle where I live, but certainly there are some parts of the metro and some parts of the city that are being serviced well, but others are being overlooked. Again, it's a spider web and there's no bits that join those spokes.
The multi-billion dollar Sydney Metro is one of the coalition government's signature infrastructure projects. But promised lines in the western suburbs are incomplete or in doubt, and there's a $6 billion cost blowout.
Give credit where credit is due in terms of what the Liberal government has done, but I think it's time for a fresh perspective.
Archaeology student Angus is also a regular metro user, but he thinks the money would have been better spent elsewhere.
I mean, if they expand it, sure, but I really don't think that should be a priority right now. I think money should be going towards hospitals and education.
One stop up the line is Epping, which sits in Premier Dominic Perrottet's electorate. There I meet Peter Davis.
My only concern about any of the infrastructure is we seem to be selling off so many public assets into privatisation that seems to pay for it. I think there's got to be a better way.
He's steering away from the major parties in this election.
Actually, I've got a pox on both their houses. I'm really worried about corruption and integrity in politics and in the current system.
Opinion polls show the race is tight, and politics professor Rodney Smith from the University of Sydney says infrastructure is a key point of difference in an otherwise bland contest.
This campaign's been marked by the lack of a really big policy contest between the major parties, but I think it has become an issue. So you've got a clear distinction between the Labor Party and the coalition on the Northern Beaches link, for example, with Labor saying it's going to scrap that. You've got a distinction between the parties on the extent to which they're committed to new metro lines, particularly out in Western Sydney. You've got differences on WestConnex and tolls and so on. So there are issues in terms of infrastructure for different voters to think about, and the parties have made somewhat different pitches.
And after more than a decade in power, Professor Smith says that's a harder task for the government.
By the same token, the opposition can point to areas where it has not delivered what it's promised.
Some voters have already made up their minds. 12% of people have already cast their ballot.
Matt Bamford with that report. Australia has some amazing and vibrant underwater habitats, and citizen scientists have been helping researchers get a better idea of what's happening below the surface due to climate change. A new report finds while some shallow water reef species living around our continent's coastlines have increased, the majority have dropped during the past 10 years. Isabel Masali reports.
On the ocean floor off the WA coast, divers spot three juvenile sea dragons. It's an exciting discovery, and one Robin Benkin knows well.
And you're hovering there waiting to see one, and then you think you see one, and of course it's just a piece of seaweed, and hours and days later, and then you see one and you get so excited you nearly swallow half an ocean of water.
About 10 years ago, her community group Cottesloe Coast Care successfully pushed the WA government to declare the weedy sea dragon a protected species. It was a mammoth effort, and even Sir David Attenborough gave his support.
We were very thrilled. It was a long campaign, and we didn't think it was going to happen. It might have gone on longer if it wasn't for our friend Sir David. But, but you know, I went and chatted to all the dive clubs and, you know, dive clubs and snorkel clubs all over southern Western Australia, you know, were signing petitions. And you know, giving their support.
But with numbers of weedy sea dragons down 59%, their work to protect them continues. It's one of more than 1,000 reef species across Australia being highlighted in a study out today. The lead author is University of Tasmania Professor Graham Edgar.
So it's far and away the biggest study that's ever been done anywhere in the world in terms of trying to assess at the continental scale changes that are happening out of sight underwater.
Researchers found between 2008 and 2021, more than half of the reef species saw a population decline. And in the case of 28 species, including a type of electric ray and other fish, numbers were down more than 80%.
And the declines were much more pronounced along the southern Australian coast than in the tropical waters. So regardless of all the attention paid to the Great Barrier Reef, which is deserved in terms of the impacts that are occurring there with heat waves, we found that species along the southern Australian coast showed even greater declines in general.
The researchers say this shows greater conservation efforts are needed.
Basically, we need to put much more effort into considering what's happening and putting in the mechanisms to safeguard these species, because they're declining out of sight and you know, very little management attention has been paid to them beforehand.
He says fishing, pollution and development, along with climate impacts, are all contributing, but he points to marine protected areas as one example of an initiative that'll make a difference if more are introduced.
Isabel Masali reporting there. More than 40,000 people, half of them children under five, are likely to have died in Somalia during the past year because of a hunger crisis fueled by drought and conflict. The confronting figures come from a report released this week by the UN and Somali government, and it also predicts another 30,000 people might die before June. Reporter Stephanie March travelled to Somalia for this story, and a warning, some listeners may find it distressing.
At a dusty, dry camp for displaced people in Dolo in southwestern Somalia, a caravan of 24 people appears on the horizon. An aid worker tells them to gather in family groups. 30-year-old Aisha Sugal has arrived with her 1-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son. While her children rode in a donkey cart, she walked 30 kilometres a day for 10 days with no food and very little water, and she's 7 months pregnant. The drought killed her relatives' only source of income, livestock, and she was desperate to escape the oppressive control of Al-Shabaab militants.
Where I come from, Al-Shabaab hide in the bush. If you own anything, they come and take it from you. Even though we had almost nothing, they would take it anyway.
The town Aisha has arrived in, Dolo, is under government control, but the insurgents are never far away. Before leaving, she was forced to make a decision no mother should have to. There was no room on the donkey cart for all four of her children. She left her 3- and 4-year-old daughters behind with her husband.
I was so worried about them, but I couldn't bear to stay while all the kids were hungry. I was hungry, they were hungry, it was unbearable. So by leaving with these two, I could at least get some help for them. And hopefully I can bring the others later.
Aisha's one of the more than 1 million people in Somalia who've been displaced over the past 2 years. 6 million people don't have enough food to eat. The World Food Programme is feeding more people in Somalia than ever, and parts of the country are at risk of falling into famine later this year. Adam Abdelmullah, the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia, says funding for this crisis has been hard to come by, as many donors have focused on the war in Ukraine.
Traditional donors more or less wash their hands from Somalia, and if that continues, we will see a huge catastrophe in this country this year.
The Australian government has given $5 million directly towards the hunger crisis in Somalia, compared with more than $60 million during the last famine in 2011. back at the camp as we're filming, our security team overhear a man on the phone telling someone there are foreigners in the camp.
We need to get moving. Kind of now.
With Al-Shabaab not far away, we're rushed into armoured cars.
Let's go, keep walking to the car, come on. Now!
We speed away to safety, a luxury millions of people here don't have. This is Stephanie March in Dolo, Somalia, reporting for AM.
And you can see more of Stephanie's story on Foreign Correspondent 8 o'clock tonight on ABC TV or on iView. Despite the worst banking crisis in decades, the US Federal Reserve has once again hiked interest rates. The quarter of a percentage point rise is the ninth in a row, and the central bank is now still clearly worried about the risk of inflation. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
Chair Jerome Powell stepping up to the podium to explain why the Federal Reserve has decided interest rates need to go even higher, even while banking turmoil keeps markets on edge.
Inflation remains too high and the labor market continues to be very tight. My colleagues and I understand the hardship that high inflation is causing, and we remain strongly committed to bringing inflation back down to our 2% goal.
With this hike, rates are now at a level unseen since before the global financial crisis, and it comes after a painful reminder of that time. Less than 2 weeks ago, Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest in the United States, collapsed. Signature Bank failed 2 days later, and regulators moved to restore confidence, extending a guarantee on all deposits at the two banks. Today, Jerome Powell was trying again to quell unease.
Our banking system is sound and resilient with strong capital and liquidity. We will continue to closely monitor conditions in the banking system and are prepared to use all of our tools as needed to keep it safe and sound.
But the rapid implosion of global behemoth Credit Suisse just a few days ago has only increased the fears of widespread weakness. Economist Brett Ryan from Deutsche Bank says investors are likely to be skeptical of the soothing words from officials.
We've had regulators telling us for the past 10 years, the banking system is super safe, it's sound, well capitalized, and out of the blue, you get an issue like this, that's going to dent confidence. And that's going to dent investor confidence in the economy.
He believes recent data showing entrenched inflation would have prompted the Federal Reserve to hike by 0.5%, if not for the recent bank collapses. Those failures will have a similar impact to higher interest rates. Banks are likely to raise the cost of money to deal with the increased risks apparent in the economy.
Additional regulatory scrutiny, but also market conditions that, and, you know, I would say put more on market conditions, they're going to cause the banks to be, you know, more wary about lending conditions going forward.
Jerome Powell's rate hike won't make him any more popular with Americans carrying credit card or car loan debt, but he's also under pressure from politicians. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has previously called on Jerome Powell to be sacked. Today, she unveiled a new plan, co-sponsored by Conservative Republican Rick Scott, for a new external watchdog to oversee the Federal Reserve. Attacking the Fed seems to be one of the few causes with bipartisan support in the Capitol. This is Carrington Clark in Washington, reporting for AM.
Lawyers for Fox News and the voting machine company Dominion Systems have wrapped up arguments in a defamation hearing in the US state of Delaware. Fox told the court its executives couldn't be held liable for the shows on the cable news network where wild conspiracy theories were aired about the 2020 presidential election. But Dominion says the responsibility for that goes all the way to the top. North America correspondent Barbara Miller was in court.
Over 2 days of arguments, the court was given an overview of the case in which Dominion Voting Systems is suing Fox News and Fox Corporation for the airing of false allegations that their voting systems were rigged to flip votes to Joe Biden and had been created to produce altered voting results in Venezuela. Today, Fox finished its arguments for why Judge Eric Davis should simply rule in their favour, saying Dominion was seeking to punish them for covering the most newsworthy story of the time, that President Trump and lawyers affiliated with him were claiming the election was stolen. Fox lawyer Aaron Murphy argued Fox Corporation executives, including Rupert Murdoch, did not belong in the case at all. She said just because they could have stepped in to stop lawyers Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani coming on the network's flagship shows and spouting conspiracy theories, that didn't mean they were actually involved in the decision-making. Just because they could do it, we're going to presume that they're responsible all the time? She asked. Fox Corporation doesn't belong in the case at all. In rebuttal, Dominion argued emails from Rupert Murdoch showed he knew about Fox broadcasting false allegations and did not step in, as he could have and should have. Dominion rejected Fox's argument that what the network was broadcasting were allegations and not statements of fact. Lawyer Rodney Smaller said you couldn't sprinkle legal fairy dust over the statements to make them allegations which were not defamatory. Dominion said Fox mainstreamed the Dominion fault-rigging conspiracy and made relevant Sidney Powell, an otherwise little-known lawyer who became affiliated with Donald Trump. With the arguments now wrapped, it's up to Judge Eric Davis to decide whether or not to issue a full or partial summary judgment in favour of one of the parties. If he doesn't, the case will go to a jury on April the 17th. And what a trial that would be. Texts and emails from some of Fox's biggest stars, including Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity, dissected in open court, and the possibility some could be called as witnesses. Judge Davis told the court that he preferred live testimony if people are available. This is Barbara Miller in Wilmington, Delaware, reporting for AM.
Princesses, pirates and planets, when it comes to children's books, there's so much to choose from. Yet stories featuring characters with disability have been missing from our shelves. But a new series is being launched to change that, with the hope it'll start discussions about how people with vision impairment live and work. More now from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
Matt Formston has always loved to surf.
I'm a bit of a extreme sports person, and being blind, they don't really blend too well together, except surfing. Like on a surfboard, you fall off, you go fast as you like, do whatever you want, as crazy as you like, and fall off and you're in water. And it's just a safe place to be reckless and have no consequences.
The 44-year-old Paralympian and professional surfer from the New South Wales mid-north coast lives with macular dystrophy. He has 5% vision. A dad to three children, he says he never read stories about people like him.
There's no representation of people with disabilities in most books, certainly not when I was growing up. There might have been an occasional person in a wheelchair and their prognosis was very bleak. There certainly wasn't a celebration of that person being, you know, anything apart from a person that was disabled.
Come over to my house, come over and play. I'll show you around. You can stay the whole
That's day. Me reading to my one-year-old. I can't see the words on the page because I'm blind. I've been reading to my son by listening to an audiobook through headphones and then repeating what I hear. But while I've figured that bit out, it's been hard to find books about people with disability like me.
E-I-E-I-O.
E-I-E-I-O.
Turn the page.
That's until now. Matt's story of vision loss and sporting success has been turned into a book. It's one of three being launched today by Vision Australia to increase representation of disability in literature. What makes these books different is that Braille features alongside the text.
The first book is about Matt Formston. The second book is about blind chef. And the third book is about blind fashion designer.
That's Vision Australia's Vildana Praljak, who's leading the project. She also lives with vision impairment and says the stories tackle difficult topics like discrimination, but it's all explained in a child-friendly way.
It is really about normalising the fact that it doesn't matter how you engage with this world, how you engage with your peers, you're still part of the Australian story.
Vildana lost her sight in her 20s, but says for those facing a similar diagnosis in their younger years, books like these could help.
I've just looked around for any sort of role models, anyone that can really inspire or just kind of move me from this kind of status quo of the point that I just couldn't see the future for myself. And I simply could not do that.
And for Matt Formston, it's about teaching the wider community what people with disability can achieve.
Just because you have a disability doesn't mean you can't do things. And by me educating the wider community, that creates opportunities for people with disabilities to be supported.
Paralympian Matt Formston, ending that report by Naz Campanella. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
We're all facing the financial pressures that come with the spiralling cost of everything. But on the weekend, it's New South Wales residents who'll get the chance to punish politicians for it. Today, the ABC's election analyst, Anthony Green, on why the state coalition government might not survive Saturday's election as Australians find it harder and harder to make ends meet. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.